Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peachtree Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peachtree Pandemonium.
All right, welcome to Peachtree Pandemonium for this week. It's been a couple weeks without the show, and this voice you're hearing is obviously not Mike Norris. This is Rich Tate filling in for Mike this week, and just want to welcome everybody to the show and let you know that later on we're going to, well, actually probably in about 15 minutes or so, we're going to have on Jay West, and let's see, about an hour. A little bit more than that. We got an announcement about the future of this show coming up. Bobby, you're with us tonight. Jerry is not. Not sure if he's going to be here or not. He said he had a meeting that might run late. You had some dental work done today.
Yeah, I had to have a crown replaced today or glued back in. But other than a bad cold, I'm hanging in there. How are you, Rich?
I'm doing all right. It's been, of course, I've been on a hiatus since the end of the year, and Ringside Rap went on a break. But as you can tell, Les has been quite busy putting the WCA thing together. Of course, we had a big announcement about that today on the GWH News website, as well as Ringside Rap. We do hope that show will get back on the air probably within a year. But anyway, this show's been off for a couple of weeks. Bobby, you want to let folks know what's been going on during the downtime?
Well, we had our Gulf Coast Wrestling reunion was last week, and it was actually 2 weeks ago now. We had a wonderful reunion. We spent 4 days down there, and we had our first annual Lee Fields Hall of Fame inductions for both wrestling and race car driving. For people not familiar with Lee, he was the promoter in the Gulf Coast. But he also owned Mobile Raceway that has NASCAR, what used to be the Busch Series races. And it was a dream of Bob Kelly to start the Hall of Fame, and we had that weekend. Had a wonderful weekend up until we separated and parted company about 8 o'clock Saturday night. For those of you that may not have heard, Michael Norris left. He dropped off a couple of folks at the hotel, and he went home. He had been up for two straight days working on reunion stuff, and when he got home, he was welcomed to the sound of ambulances and sirens, and his house was on fire when he got home. His parents were in the house. The firemen didn't know they were in there. Michael tried to, of course, charge into the house. They stopped him, but they went in. They brought his parents out. They called me. Not only am I a very dear friend of Michael's, and he's a dear friend of mine, I'm also his pastor. So on that part, I'm glad I was there. We got to him within about 10 minutes. We got to him. The house was still burning. We could still see the flames. Long story short, his dad's recovering slowly, surely. Michael's mom passed away the Tuesday after that Saturday night incident. And we had the privilege last Saturday of going back to Mobile and conducting her memorial service. So that was a tough time. Tough time for Michael. Michael's taking a little time off, and he'll be back, but he's just a lot of things he's having to handle right now. The other thing that happened to us reunion weekend, which I'm sure everybody has heard about, was Paul Bearer, Percy Pringle, Bill Moody, however you knew him. I hugged his neck Saturday about 2 o'clock, 2:15. Told him I loved him. Talked to him later in the week, which we did converse about once a week, and Monday afternoon, about somewhere around 4 or 5 o'clock, Bill Moody passed on. So we were able to attend his wake last Friday night. So it's been a busy couple of weeks, but that's kind of what's been going on, Rich.
Yeah, obviously some sad stuff going on, and our best wishes go out to Mike and his family, and of course Bill's family as well. You know, I got to meet Bill a few times down in Mobile, and got to sit and chat with him a little bit when they did the they were doing a reunion here. I can't remember which one it was. I think it was the Wrestle Reunion event that came here when WrestleMania came to Atlanta, and got to sit and chat with him a little bit there. That was probably the last time I saw him. It was just a few years ago, but just a sweet guy and a lot of fun to talk to.
Super guy. Just me and him would laugh. He was Bill was a couple of years older than me. He would have been 59 here in April, or a year older, I guess. I'll be 58 this year. But Bill, same way I was. He went to the matches every week. He was a huge fan. His hero was Bob Kelly. He was just a huge fan, and it was his dream to get into the wrestling business. And, you know, we talked about this the other day. You know, there was a bunch of those guys went to school together down there. You think about right along that little Gulf Coast area right there, you had Bill Moody, you had Michael Hayes, you had Reuben and Robert Gibson, or Reuben Robert, same guy, but Ricky Gibson.
Right.
I mean, all of these guys came out of that same little area there, and they all went on to be pretty big stars in our industry. And they just all had that desire. They had that fire. Even though the chances are slimmer now of breaking into the business and being successful, if you got that dream, folks, just keep plugging away, because who knows? You know, you might get the break you need.
Yeah, I never got to see a lot of Gulf Coast wrestling on TV, but I did see a picture floating around after his passing last week that showed him in a very young him and a very young Michael Hayes and Terry Gordy and together, and I just thought that was the greatest photo. I'd never seen that before.
Yeah, he told me when they broke in, him and Michael were very close, and when they broke in together, they were working a little independent promotion in Mississippi, and he said they made a lot of trips together. And Terry came down and hooked up with them and made the trips with them and work. You know, Terry was just a kid when all of this was going on. I had a chance here within the past year to see a videotape of Lou Fez promotion when he was running up in Tennessee, Kentucky, and that part of the world, and saw a 14-year-old Terry Gordy wrestling under a mask. And I would have had no idea who it was, but the person that gave me the tape told me who it was. And as you watched him, you could see the mannerisms. But yeah, it was a tight knit group of those guys, and they stayed tight their whole careers. But yeah, Bill started out wrestling, but Frankie Kane gave him the name Percy Pringle, and that's where he first got his notoriety when he went to Dallas as a manager.
Yeah, I guess from what I understand, there were actually more Percy Pringles. So the three, you know, the third after his name, I guess that makes sense. But I'd never actually heard of any of the others.
Me neither. He's the one. Every time I hear the name, that's the one that comes to mind.
Yeah. And of course, some great work in Dallas by him as well. That was just good stuff out there. And him and Undertaker, I guess that's kind of, if I'm not mistaken, that's where him and Undertaker ended up. Actually, first hooking up.
Yeah, he met Mark in Dallas, and then he got the break in '91 to go with Vince, or to go to work for Vince, and it went from there. I met Mark Calloway last Friday night. It's the first time I'd ever met him.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna tell you something. If you never met this fella, I shook hands with him, and his hand, the tip of his fingers to the back or the top of his wrist, was as long as my hand to my elbow. He is huge. I mean, he is a monster. Nice guy, very soft spoken, but he what a huge guy. Me and Joe Turner were sitting together, and I told Joe, I said, "Can you imagine being hit with one of them clubs?"
Oh man, yeah, I got to meet Big Show once, and I got to figure it's probably about the same thing.
Oh.
Dude's huge. What a
moment. Yeah, I'll never forget the first time I met Andre. I mean, it's just you cannot describe. I mean, you know how big he was. And when I first met him, he was still very young. And when they said he was 7'4", 500 pounds, they wasn't exaggerating. And, I mean, I was about 220, 240, and about 6'2". And he would pick me up like a rag doll and set me on the top rope. I mean, it was unbelievable. And you would pray, "God, please don't ever get mad at me."
Oh, man. Let's see what else we got going on. Let's do this. I know you guys are mostly about the history on this show, but I do want to point out some good news that we had come up. Let me pull up the story here. Talked about it earlier, I guess. I made a brief mention about Les being busy. Les Thatcher, of course, he's running the Wrestling Cares Association. They're going to be kicking off their event. Their first event's going to happen in Los Angeles on April 27th. But we got a story up on GWH News about this. Kyle Matthews and Wardell Walker, both Georgia-based guys, are actually going to be on that first card. So congrats to them.
Yeah, that's in talking with Les, we had him on the show here 2-3 weeks ago, and he was telling us that he's only going to use the top guys from around the country as best he can determine. And there was a couple of names that was brought up as coming out of here.
Yeah, they're going to have Kyle, at least on this first card. What's happening is Kyle's going to be working with Colt Cabana, which that ought to be just a great matchup right there. And then Wardell Walker's working a guy I'm not real familiar with, but Pepper Parks. And a couple other big names these days from Ring of Honor. Davey Richards going up against Kyle O'Reilly. And then, of course, Caprice Coleman has wrestled around the Southeast quite a bit. He'll be there working against Steve Anthony. And another good matchup is Adam Cole and Anthony Nice. So should be pretty good stuff. 25% of those ticket sales are going to be donated to Scott Schwartz Children's Foundation. So I don't know if maybe you can make donations online or if there's going to be DVDs or what, but go check it out at wrestlingcares.com/home, and that should get you there.
I've met the gentleman that Les is working in conjunction with, nice fella, and they're really positive about this, and they're really working hard to make this successful. So anybody that might be listening that's going to be in that area, man, you want to go out and support that. It's if Thatcher's involved in it, you're going to see some quality wrestling. You're going to you'll be pleasantly surprised, I'm sure.
Absolutely. You know, the funny thing is, I've known him, I guess, now for, I don't know, 10, 11 years, 12 years, and I'd never, ever heard anybody say a bad thing about him. I mean, there's a couple of guys that you know, for whatever reason, they just, you know, rubbed him wrong. Or he's rubbed them wrong, a couple guys in the business. But for the most part, you know, aside from those two, I've never heard anybody say anything bad about him. But he does get kind of a bad rap among
about Thatcher.
Oh yeah.
Oh, he's a bum. He's really not worth a hoot. But he's no. Les is if you've ever worked with Les in any capacity, whether I never had the privilege of working in a ring with him, he had kind of gotten into the other side of the business by the time that I had gotten started real well. So I never worked with him in the ring. But I worked with him on a lot of production sides of things where we were doing TVs together or, you know, that sort of thing, or analysis for programs or whatever it was. But, he has a tremendous amount of knowledge, and he just dealing with Les is like dealing with Ole, but on a far, far milder scale, if that makes sense. When you deal with Les, you know where you stand.
Yep.
I mean, there's no gray area. He'll tell you what he thinks. You may not agree with him, but it's his opinion. And not that I've ever disagreed with him, but it's just that you know where you stand with him, and he's very, you know. We're going to do a telethon on this show in the not-too-distant future, and We're gonna try to raise money for Dick Steinborn and Les Thatcher to get them to come out of their shell, you know. But that's but seriously, you know, you're right. Les, good guy, and me neither. You can't get along with everybody, but most everybody I've ever run into likes Les Thatcher.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the funny thing is not just teaching guys in the ring and what to do there, but, you know, just doing ringside rap with him on the other show, you know, for as long as we did. I've learned, you know, things from him about just, you know, putting the show together, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And how to conduct interviews and this, that, and the other. He can teach anything.
Well, I got to figure if he can teach you, then, hey, he, you know.
I got to tell you, I've been a project for a lot of years. My wife can tell you that. Oh, Lord. All right. Should be joined here briefly or momentarily by Jay West. Waiting to see him show up here on the line. We do have a few callers, so let's just go ahead and try to breeze through these. I'm sure some of these are people that are just listening to us, but we'll call out your area code because we can't see your name. I'll call out your area code, and I only got one from each one, so if you want to be on the line, speak up. Let's see. We're going to area code 615. I believe that's Central Tennessee. You're on the line.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, this is Charles.
All right,
Nashville.
Charles. All right.
Yeah, everyone around here knows me as Chicken Hat.
Oh, yeah, we've heard of you. What's up tonight? What's up tonight?
Well, nothing much. I'm switching off between Idol and Impact. And tonight, because of what happened this past Sunday, I'm just leaving it on mute.
That always works. That's always the best way to do it. All right. Well, we'll keep you on the line here, and you can hang out. Let's see. Go to get the board to work here. Let's go to 706 area code, and you are on the line. 706 area code. And you don't want to be on the line. All right. And we've done that one. We got somebody calling from Skype. Is there a Skype user on the line wanting to get on here? Hello? All right. I love it.
We're doing good.
Yeah.
At least we didn't get a Magic Jack commercial, so that's a good thing.
Sure. All right, hang on. We got one more here. 770 area code. You're on the line.
Well, hello, guys. Jay West
hello.
Here.
Hey, Jay, that's a number I didn't recognize there. How you doing?
Well, that's the story of my life, you know. It's, you're somebody, but I'm not quite sure who it is.
All right. Let's see. For a little bit of an introduction here, this is Jay West. For those that don't know Jay, he was a ring announcer for Georgia Championship Wrestling TV and some house shows between, I believe, 1974 and about 1982, Jay. Is that right?
And that's correct. You wrote stuff down real good. I applaud you on taking notes. In starting, first of all, Bobby and Rich, I'd like to send my condolences out to Mike Norris and his family. And Bobby, I don't know how you do it, man. I read the Wrestling Observer every week, and as you know, guys from our era are dropping like flies, and you're always there to help the family and do what you can for them. And I want to personally thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that.
And, you know, when I saw Mike at the Nightmare to Remember in middle of February, it's the first time I'd done anything wrestling-related in 30 years, and other than get together with you guys occasionally. And he was so happy that night. He was talking about Mobile. And, you know, and he asked me that night if I'd want to be on the show. Of course, I've always had the Freddie Miller philosophy. If you get an opportunity to be on the air, you take it. And so at any rate, I said yes, and, you know, just had no idea at that point what was going to happen in the next few days. And the next thing I know, Bobby's giving me a call and giving me an update. And it's just, you know, you got to live one day at a time and do the best you can. That's what I've decided at my old age here.
There you go. I tell people every day, step at a time, day at a time, and enjoy the ride.
Absolutely. Okay, if you guys got any questions or what you want to know about me or what other than how much I got in the bank, I'd be happy to talk about it.
Well, how much do you have in the bank?
Not enough. Absolutely not enough.
You know, I'm sure Mike wanted to have you on to just kind of talk about your career and have people talk, you know, have you from, or I guess let people know what you had done over the years. I kind of know the story, but let the listeners know how you got involved with Georgia Championship Wrestling.
Well, you know, and Bobby can relate to this. There's two ways to look at it. Some people say I owe it to Charlie Smith. Others say, doggone Charlie Smith, it's his fault I got involved in this. And actually, you know, it's pretty much the same story. I was good bit older than you, Rich, and a few years older than you, Bobby. So I can remember Dumont wrestling from the early 50s, you know. And I go back that far. Yes, that far. And, of course, when Live Atlanta Wrestling started, which was really Live Atlanta Wrestling, I remember that. And, you know, I followed it from the beginning, real fan. And I got into radio after I got out of the Army in 1968. And I had been familiar with the program. And, of course, I'd followed Freddie Miller because he had two of the most iconic shows there were on television, and Dialing for Dollars, which, you know, everybody knew that show, and The Stars of Tomorrow. And so that had been one connection. I knew Ed Caprell from the days he was a movie host in town. So, you know, I knew these guys' backgrounds. I had seen Gordon in Florida when I was working at a station in Albany doing the show from down there. So, and it was totally different than anything I'd ever seen before, the championship wrestling from Florida. And, you know, I had great respect for him right off the top. But at any rate, to make a long story longer, in the 1972, when I was working at WSSA in Marl, we did a little country music show out at Indian Lake in Jonesboro, and had some pretty well-known stars of the time out there. And during the show, we had a little break between, as Rich, as you know how musicians are, when one's breaking down and the other's getting ready to go.
Oh, yeah.
And some look not fast enough when they're not ready for you to get on. But at any rate, Charlie and his family were sitting in the audience. You know, and Bobby, you know, Charlie's wife is a great country music fan.
Yep.
And so she dragged him out there on his day off. And I recognized him from the TV show. And so I just made a little quip. I said, well, I always wondered what a TV wrestling referee did on his day off. And ladies and gentlemen, Charlie Smith in the audience. And, of course, he beamed and, you know, took a bow. And
photo op.
That's right. And, you know, the rest is history. We became friends. So he would, you know, anytime any opportunity would come up, he would say, well, what about Jay West? And I'd say, oh, no, he's not smart. He doesn't know anything. But at any rate, in addition to that, I met a guy named Jim Bell that worked at a Griffin station. And Jim was the ring announcer in Griffin as a side job. And at some point there in 74, Jim had decided he had become the ring announcer on the TV show that he wanted to become a referee. So he talked to Freddie, and Freddie called me. And so that kind of started it. I started doing the TV show as a ring announcer in the summer of 1974, and that's when they were doing the hour shows, and because All South was still in business. And I did that for several months, but I had the musicians I was working with, we were doing a lot of work, so I had to make a decision sometimes as to what I could do. So at any rate, after 4 or 5 months, Freddie went back to doing the ring announcing, and I think that's when Les Thatcher came into the show for a while, because I never worked with Les on the show, but I know he was on there with Gordon as co-host sometime after I left in 74. But at any rate, next year, Jim Bell called me, and he was wanting to give up the Griffin thing. So I started working at the old Griffin Sports Palace in Griffin. You remember that place, Bobby?
Yes, sir.
And that's the one you want to write about in your memories.
Yes.
And at any rate, I started working down there and did that for a while. And then all of a sudden late 75, I got a call from Charlie. And he was working with Eddie Ihorn's group, the IWA, at that point. And he asked me to come out to Porterdale one night and do a battle royal for him out there. So I got a little more experience doing that. And then Freddie called me again, and he was going to start doing spot shows on Friday night. So he asked me to take over doing the city auditorium as the ring announcer on Friday nights. So I was doing Griffin on Saturday nights and the city auditorium on Saturday pretty regularly after 75. And still, I wasn't doing the TV show at that point, but at any rate, because I was working radio on the weekends. And but I started doing more of that kind of stuff. And then in 78, Freddie called me again, and this was an interesting story. Gordon, in 78, left the TV show for a little while. You know, you know about that, Bobby?
Yes.
And at any rate, because of that, Freddie had to take over doing the show for a little while. And so he called me and wanted to know if I'd come in and ring announce again. And so I did, and basically from that point on, I stayed doing the ring announcing on television through middle of 81, which I think probably was the all-time high of Georgia Championship Wrestling, certainly not because of me, but because of the booking and the talent that was coming in and out of that area at the time, and, of course, getting on the Superstation and the things that was going on. Georgia really made a name for itself between, I'd say, 77, 78, and through 81. Then Doug Smith started promoting in Marietta, and I started doing Marietta on Sunday nights, so I was doing TV and three shows and live shows, and then the Omni started, and I worked that, and that was pretty much my career through 81. There's nothing like getting in front of 18,000 fans down at the Omni and getting in the ring and hearing the bell ring and starting that show. That was, you know, that was one of the highlights of my career. And I enjoyed every minute of it. And that's pretty much what I did. I also started writing for the Wrestling News, and that was a pretty good publication at that time. And Jim Melby was the editor, and did quite a few stories for them. Did one on Gordon, did one on the Freebirds. So, you know, the guys trusted me, and the Wrestling News was different than the After mags in that After during that time would take pictures and make up stories. The Wrestling News, they would try to stay, they certainly didn't try to give away the business, but they would try to be as, you know, close to accurate as possible in the stories they do on the guys within their, you know, ring personas. And so, you know, I enjoyed doing that, and did that for, that was pretty much one of the last things I did, except after I left Georgia Championship Wrestling, which was not my decision to do. I did work for Thunderbolt Patterson for a little while. I did a couple of shows for him on TV, and did some spots that appeared on 46. And Charlie called me, and I did some voiceovers for some small shows that Charlie was involved in. The last one was probably in 82. And Ted Oates, Ted Allen worked that show, and I know Bill Dromo worked that show wherever it was, somewhere. And the last actual thing I did was for Ted Allen in 82 down in somewhere around Griffin. No, it wasn't Griffin. It was Douglasville at an armory there. And I did a show for him. Dromo was on that show. And the guy that was in the main event, Marty Lund, And he worked under a mask, and I didn't know who he was, but he'd been trained by Ted, and they called him the Superstar that night, and he was great, and it wasn't too much longer, within 3 or 4 weeks, that Arn Anderson appeared on Georgia Championship Wrestling. So that's pretty much the highlight of my wrestling career there, guys.
What'd you do with your spare time on the weekend?
Well, fortunately at that time, you know, and it's you know, well, you knew the life, Bobby, you're doing the same thing. But at any rate, you know, between that, I was working at either a radio station or teaching at one of the schools in town during the week, teaching broadcasting. I had a real understanding. My first wife was real understanding. And, you know, I'd come home and sleep a little bit here and there and either go to the she'd have to tell me, keep the book, tell me whether I was supposed to be going to the radio station or to the TV station or to school and what day it was. So,
well, geez.
You know, so it worked out. It worked out. And, you know, folks thought I made a lot of money, but most people in broadcasting didn't make much money, and they didn't make much money doing what I was doing in wrestling, but you did it because you liked it, you know.
Well, you know, I was – you were talking about how you were doing the weekends and stuff. See, that – you know, people – it becomes – you talk about living the life. It's not a job. It becomes a lifestyle.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's something – you know, and you're either inbred with it that you love it, or you hate it. There's not really an in between there, because if there's any in between in there, you choose not to do it.
Right.
And it was just, I started. You're talking about the Sports Palace. I started work when I was 14, running errands for Charlie Harbin.
Mm-hmm.
I put the TV ring up on Saturday morning, and then I went to Griffin on Saturday night and tore tickets on the front door.
Right.
And sold programs at that.
You did whatever you could
up there.
you did whatever you could do.
Yeah, and then and you know, I mean, all of a sudden I was making like $25 on the weekend for something I'd been paying to do my whole life. And then that led to ushering at the auditorium, and it led to other, and you know, eventually it led me in the ring, and that's I mean, it's just you paid your dues, but eventually it paid off for most of us, and that's.
Speaking of the auditorium, I remember the you know, Paul Jones making one of his rare appearances, but the last night at the auditorium, that was quite an event, and it was sad in a lot of ways. At the end of December of 1979, it got a lot of newspaper coverage, which, you know, wrestling at that time got nil in Atlanta, and you know, they came out for that, and it was a big night, and I was happy to see professional wrestling in the city get some of the coverage that it shouldn't have gotten. It was unfortunate that it was, you know, because the auditorium was closing, which I always thought was a mistake. But at any rate, they had a great card that night. And Ted Allen told me that, you know, in one of the sit-downs that we had during our little lunches there that you put on, that was the only time he ever worked at the City Auditorium was the last night. He always carried his bag with him in case somebody had a spot for him.
Right.
And whoever was supposed to be in the opening match that night, he wasn't there. And Ole said, you got your bag, kid? And Ted said, of course, and he got into the opening match that night, which he wasn't scheduled for. So he got to be part of history on that evening as being in the first match of the last card held at the Atlanta City Auditorium.
I wrote a story for Kayfabe Memories about this, and I probably talked about it with Rich in the interview me and him did for his Peach State Pandemonium magazine. But that night you're talking about, I sat in the dressing room till everybody had left the building. I mean, there wasn't a swinging soul left in that building but me. And I walked all across that stage and down those steps, and I went out and I stood in the middle of the ring. And I absolutely stood there and cried like a baby.
I don't doubt it.
I grew up as a fan in Atlanta going to into that building with my uncle as a kid, all up. I graduated from high school in that building.
I did, too.
I just, you know, it was, I couldn't believe it was over. And you know.
I understand. My daddy took me to see the Shrine Circus there.
Oh, yeah.
And when I worked for WPLO in the early 70s, I mean, they had the Shower of Stars there, which was the big thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I did four shows with the Shower of Stars, and all the top entertainers came through there. And, you know, I did one little show there in the last year also. And, of course, it did, you know, the Omni was there, and folks had moved on to bigger and better things. But it was... you know, it just had so many memories, and it was just really sad to see that building gone, and just now to know that the facade of the front's still there, but the folks have no idea at this time what actually took place in that building.
No. I worked it. I sold cotton candy and snow cones for Holiday on Ice when they came every year.
Oh yeah,
All kind of but you know, I come home from work. I leave my office. My office is on Peachtree Street in downtown Atlanta. Every day I come down Cortland Street and I go right by the front of that place, and almost every day a red light catches me right there in front of the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I sit there and I think, my God, you know, people, these students that are walking up and down the street down at Georgia State, I said, they have no clue. funny story, Bill Bowman's son Brian graduated from Georgia State, and he said, I can't remember what year he said, it might have been his senior year, I can't remember, but he said he did not buy a yearbook that year. He said, so when he was sitting in the little cafe up there where we used to go eat on Friday nights, he said somebody had a yearbook, and he said, can I look at it? And he was looking through it, and he said they had a spread in the yearbook about the auditorium that Georgia State had bought it and what they were doing and things. But he said when he opened it up, he said one of the first things he saw was the picture, a big picture of a battle royal at the City Auditorium in Atlanta. And he said right in the middle of the battle royal was a picture of his dad, Bill Bowman.
No kidding.
Yeah, he said it was just, and he didn't buy a yearbook that year. So I would actually like to get my hands on a Georgia State yearbook from whatever year that was just to see that. But, yeah, they did a story on the auditorium after they purchased it. But I told, I may have told you this, I don't know, but, you know, the city offered that building to Barnett.
Right.
They were going to lease it to, you know, he could have got it for almost nothing.
Yep.
But he had to maintain it, keep it up. And, you know, we looked at it, and I did some research, and we, you know, it was almost, it was a white elephant. You would have had to have kept that thing rented almost every day in order to keep, just to break even. I mean, the wrestling did good, but nothing else was doing good because you're right. People had moved on to the bigger venues, and, the circus didn't come there anymore. Holiday on Ice had moved to the Omni.
Right.
So there was just, the opportunity just wasn't there. There was no way he could have done it.
Yeah, I thought possibly the way it was set up that, you could have, because you remember when they did some TV shows over at the sports arena.
Right.
And, that there was a possibility that, maybe that could have been turned into a TV sound studio. And, just to do the matches and things like that. Well, other opportunities were probably a lot cheaper for the office came along. But my thought was that it might have been a good facility to try to do that. But like you said, it was old, and it was going to cost a lot of money to keep that building up.
Oh, well, precious memories.
Right. Rich, you ever go to the auditorium?
I never got down there. Never got down there. My first matches were at the Omni, unfortunately.
What year?
I got to say 81.
Okay.
81.
Right. A mere child.
The first live event that I ever saw, as I said, I'd been a fan, through the TV years, but the first live event that I ever saw was when I was working at WJZ in Albany, which was Fred Ward country, of course. And so in 1971, when I was down there, they bought some time on the station WJZ where I was working that summer after I left WPLO, and we got some tickets, and at that time they were running during the summer in an open air type pavilion at a fairground, and so I went out to the matches, and it was a very small ring. And it was covered, the pavilion style. And I can remember that the main event was the Assassins against Bill Dromo and Bob Armstrong. And fans, it wasn't a big crowd, but the fans loved it. It was a good night. I'm not sure who the referee is. That probably was Leon Ogle. But at any rate, that was the first live event I ever saw. And you can see TV forever, but until you actually go to a live event and you see the fans and the interaction, you really haven't been to wrestling.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I've actually been told that I went to or I was taken to some events in Douglasville, but I don't remember them. I would have been too young, and I'm thinking probably about 74, 75. I think that's the time frame I've been told, but I don't really remember that. I remember my first memories are actually seeing it on TV. I can remember stuff in late 77.
Okay.
Early 78, maybe. I kind of remember that time frame. As far as my first time I know for a fact I went was 80, it had to be 81. Had to be 81. But, y'all call me young. I just turned 45, and I can't find my black hair anymore.
well, but, you probably are. It's probably in the sink, if you've got it.
Yeah, that it is. I wanted to ask you, you said earlier, of course, you had watched wrestling on the DuMont Network. Back then, who were your favorites when you were just watching on TV and just getting into it?
Well, if you talk about the really early days, and I'm kind of like you about, saying that I saw events, but in the early 50s, which I would have been probably, I'm 65, so I would have been 5 or 6. I can remember DuMont Television, which was on Saturdays, and it was a big network broadcast for wrestling. I mean, that was the highlights at that time, and Gorgeous George was on there, and he was kind of like the Hulk Hogan of his day because he started it all, because he would appear on Jackie Gleason's show, he would appear on Ed Sullivan's show, things like that, where your average wrestler would not. And, you know, he'd make appearances, Argentina Rocca. There was an Asian wrestler who was the main heel of that time was a guy named Mr. Moto. And I don't know if you've ever seen anything on him in any of your books you've ever read, but probably in the 53, 54, 55 time frame, and you can Google him and see stuff on him, but he was a major star going against the top faces of that time. And I do remember that. Now, getting into the early days of Atlanta Wrestling, when Ed Capel took it over, of course, Don McIntyre was there. And then, of course, Ray Gunkel came in. The Graham brothers were very big in the late 50s, and I remember them. And so, you know, that kind of started it for me. Now, when I, in the 60s, of course, I was a teenager then, and I started playing with a rock and roll band. You know what that'll do for you. But at any rate, you know, I kind of lost track a little bit. But when I was in the Army in 66 to 68, I was out in Colorado, so I saw the AWA show out there and sort of got back into it. And when I came back in 68 and the show was going strong, of course, the Assassins were the number one guys in town. And, of course, Doug Gilbert was and Bobby Shane and, you know, guys like that, Steinborn. And they were all going strong about that time, and you know, I enjoyed their work, and heel or face, even though I didn't know the term at that time, I knew they were bad guys or good guys.
Right.
But at any rate, you know, I could enjoy them for what they were doing, and you know, I'd watch soap operas, so I know the bad guys on the soap opera. If you had old ladies coming up to you in the supermarket and they throw things at you because you'd been bad to the good little girl in the soap opera, you'd done a hell of a job, you know. And that was what these guys were doing in the ring, and I could appreciate that even then. But those were kind of the guys. But you can also think that you know, I also was looking at it from a different angle, because I wanted to go into broadcasting from a very early time, and so I'd see guys like Dick Lane and Jimmy Lennon, who not only did ring announcing for wrestling, but also for boxing. My father was a big boxing fan, and so I got into that very early, and you know, I just followed them all along, and I saw most of the guys do this the 60s and 70s into the early 80s. Gordon, of course, who I consider to be the top wrestling announcer of all time. But Bob Caudle in you know, in the Mid Atlantic area, he was very good at what he did. Later on, Tony Schiavone, of course. Lance Russell's probably, I would say, out of Memphis, second to Gordon as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Gene Okerlund, who a lot of people make fun of, but he was you know, over the top kind of guy, but he knew how to do the interviews. Mm-hmm. and he, you know, he played up to the faces, but I always thought from a professional standpoint he did a good job. Now, you know, I think if you put him on the other the other end of the list, probably the worst guy I ever saw, and I'm sure he's not listening, but it was David Crockett. And
that's what made Caudle so good. He could overcome Crockett.
You know, I ring announcers, Gary Michael Capetta out of New York, that people always salivated over. I personally never saw the, you know, the excitement out of him, but. But a lot of people liked him. Les Thatcher, who was one of the guys that, you know, as you talked about, getting out of the wrestling end of it as an active athlete, but getting into it as a, you know, announcer. Les was one of the best of the guys, I think, that did that sort of thing. Bill Mercer in Texas, I think he's very underrated. Ed Capel, of course, I always loved Ed. I'd say probably of the later guys, of course, Jim Ross is looked at the top. But I think Jim, in his earlier days when he wasn't cited, sort of a caricature of what he is now, was much better. But you know, he's got to be in the top five or six. And a guy here in Georgia that I'm sure you remember, Bobby, with Jim Carlop.
Yep.
Out of Columbus. He was one of the I saw him when I was in the Army in 66. He was doing a kid show, which was not uncommon for wrestling announcers of that time to either do kid shows and movie shows, you know, movie hosts. Maybe they let them do the weather, but wrestling announcers weren't going to be doing the news. You know, that's what it was, just taboo. But anyway, I always thought Jim did a good job with what he did. So those are the kind of guys that, in addition to the actual wrestlers themselves, I was always critiquing and looking at the guys that were behind the microphone.
You know, you were talking earlier too about magazines and your contributions to the Norman Kaitzer, Jim Melby publications. You know, when I was younger, you know, the aftermags, of course, they overran the newsstands. And I'll never forget, you know, just the first time I found those magazines.
Yep.
And I was like, oh man, these are so much better. You know, yep. they're not as pretty, they're not as colorful, but you know, the stories were great, and the fact that they had correspondence reports from all over, mm-hmm. you know, different territories, and you know, people writing in and what was actually going on, and you know, just running down everybody who had appeared that month. And it'd be like, you know, 2 or 3 months behind, obviously, but you know, for the most part, you could get a good education on what was going on in the wrestling business just based on those magazines.
Absolutely. You became a smart fan whether you wanted to or not.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, you'd see by looking at the reports from around the country when a guy was leaving Mid-Atlantic and when he was going to Florida next.
Right.
And, you know, you knew that he was going to start losing and on his way out. And so that meant if he was a main event guy that he was going somewhere else. And it wouldn't be but, you know, the next issue, and you'd see where he popped up, whether you could actually see the TV show or not. And that was one of the things, even out of the 80s, cable wasn't big. And so, you know, folks didn't have anything except the wrestling magazines to really try to keep them updated on where their favorites were. And that was one of the things that Stanley Weston Publications, the After Mags, you know, that always kill me, because when they do a story that was about, the only way you'd know that the story was really nothing plausible to it was when it would be a Georgia story, and you went to see that, and the story that they put with those pictures had absolutely nothing to do with the match you saw in the ring.
Right.
And first time I talked to Jim Melby, I called him up and wanted to know if he'd be interested in, you know, a story or two. And he said, sure. And wanted to know where I was going to get pictures, and I told him I'd pitch him an idea. That's what he wanted. It wasn't the story written around the pictures. It was the pictures had to match the story.
Right.
And you know, it's the reverse of the way the aftermags were done. And so you know, I'd pitch something to him, and he'd say, okay, you got to get clearance on it. And you know, he was a very nice guy, very very soft spoken. And it seemed like Norm Kaitzer just pretty much let him run it. And it metamorphosed over the years into a different publication. And towards the end there, it became involved with the Ring magazine and became a major publication. But, you know, I was very happy to be involved with that publication and be given the opportunity to put together some stories on Wrestling 2 and Gordon and the Freebirds. And even Doug Smith's, when he started promoting down in Griffin, I got a story in there on him, and that's after they had gone totally national, because as you know from reading that publication, at one point it was a regional publication, meaning that they put out different versions for different part of the country.
Right.
And so at any rate, that sort of changed, but that was the kind of publication that I guess the promoters were a little more fearful of than the after things, because they were afraid it was going to expose some of the business. But they never did that. I mean, they they didn't do it tongue-in-cheek. They didn't cheat the fans. They didn't lie to them. But it was not a publication that was trying to make fun or put down the business or expose it in any way. It was just to put it in the very best light it could because it was written by people that love the business.
Right. You know, you guys can identify this with this. One thing I always loved about the magazines was that you did read about wrestlers around the world that, you know, you weren't necessarily seeing in your area. But the great thing about territorial wrestling to me was when those guys would come in that you'd always heard about, you'd always read about, but you'd never seen them. There was just something great about seeing somebody fresh, you know, somebody.
Oh, absolutely.
And I don't know, it was kind of like opening a present on Christmas morning. I mean, just, you know, you got somebody new in here now. And you know, it may take you a while to figure out who they may be replacing, you know, as somebody's moving down the card and out. But, you know, you don't have that now. You
nope.
Just absolutely do not have that. You know who you're going to see every week.
Yep, and there's no choice there. This is it, take it or leave it. Except for the independent groups, and you know, as you've asked me to you know, vote on a couple of things relating to the independent wrestlers, and I've told you, hey, I'm just not enough up on it. But I have seen a few of the guys now, and I'm glad they're carrying on the tradition. But it's talking about seeing you guys that you hadn't seen before. I mean, there was a lot of heartache and a lot of bad blood and everything out of the All South split away from the Atlanta booking office in 72, but I got to tell you that Georgia became a hotbed of wrestling. I know that sounds like a promo, but it became a hotbed of wrestling because of that split. We saw people in the next year in the state of Georgia, in Atlanta, between the two promotions that we wouldn't have seen in the next 10 to 15 years.
Yep.
Correct, Bobby?
No, oh, yeah. Well, I mean, when Ann split off, she took all the talent that everybody knew.
Yep.
So you got a promotion under a new name working in a different building on a different night. Well, we actually ran on Friday night to start with.
Yep.
But people knew all these people. Well, the NWA office had to start scrambling, and they were bringing people in that people had read about in the magazines, but they had never seen.
Right, right.
So they were drawing good crowds on Friday night at the auditorium, not because of the angles or not because of the hype of the matches, but because of the names they put on the cards.
Right. I just happened to have in my hand here, as you led into it, Friday night, December 8th, 1972, Ringsider, and this is, of course, right after the split.
Yep. Yeah,
and the main event for Paul Jones was World Heavyweight Title match. No increase in price. Dory Funk Jr. versus Jack Briscoe.
Mm-hmm.
Match under that was Eddie Graham versus The Pro, Bob Armstrong and Darrell Cochran, who, you know, they stuck around.
Right.
Versus Paul DeMarco and Duke Kamuka, and you know they came in because I think DeMarco was in San Francisco and Kamuka was in Texas.
Right.
And Fritz Von Erich came in. Don Curtis, I think, was in Florida. And then you had the Tennessee guys that hadn't, or they could have been in Alabama. I guess they were Alabama, Sputnik Monroe and Norvell Austin against Roy Welch and Robert Fuller. And then Jerry Jarrett and Don Green came down that night. Hiro Matsuda versus Red Dupree. And you had a girls' match opening up, Lily Thomas versus Peggy Patterson. So the NWA was supporting that from Florida, Tennessee, Texas, and California, all within that 1 week to bring in talent
mm-hmm.
to for that show. And those were people that most of them you wouldn't have seen.
That's right.
So the fans, you know, lucked out. It was very unfortunate that the situation occurred and the people that became probably enemies for life. But from a fan standpoint and also from the standpoint of Georgia becoming a major name in wrestling, and I think, you know, prior to that, it was below Mid-Atlantic. It was certainly below Florida, maybe above Alabama and Tennessee. But once that happened, Georgia was competitive as far as being a top stop for your major competitors with any promotion in around the country.
Yeah, and then it only gets better through the 70s as, you know, obviously Ted Turner putting the wrestling on, or his channel. I guess Rick Uncle actually was responsible for that. But, you know, that just as he I don't know, the visionary that he was, you know, made it possible for everybody to start seeing Georgia wrestling.
And, oh, yeah.
Oh, just great stuff.
Dunkel moving to Turner was like a blind squirrel finding an acorn. I mean, it could not have been planned. I mean, nobody knew when Turner bought that little UHF station, Channel 17 in Atlanta. We didn't have any UHF stations in Atlanta.
Right.
He was like it. I mean, you know, you would pick up Channel 30,
yeah,
which was a public broadcasting station that nobody watched.
Right.
But he came in here and he owned a little station in Charlotte.
Yep.
And Gunkel moved down there because Channel 11, where Live Atlanta Wrestling started, it went from being Live Atlanta Wrestling 6:30 to 7:30 every Saturday night, to all of a sudden it went to being taped,
yep,
and shown back, and then they would move it around. Some weeks it would be on 6:30, some weeks it'd be on 3:30 in the afternoon, some weeks it'd be on at midnight.
Well, they moved the taping of the show to Sunday.
Yeah, I remember that.
And what that happened was, the Sunday show, it ruined the continuity from a booking standpoint.
Right.
Because the Sunday show would be taped before the matches at the Atlanta City Auditorium on the Friday night.
Yep.
And so that killed it. So that, you know, they couldn't book effectively based on the fans not being able to see the continuity correct on the show.
Right.
And so that was one of the primary reasons, as I understand it, why they were looking for another place to go. And 17, where you had future billionaire Ted Turner, who at that time was the host on his own million-dollar movie on Sunday mornings,
yep,
became the new home of, as you said, what was Live Atlanta Wrestling to Georgia Championship Wrestling.
Yep. Me and Larry Nichols did a Baltimore Colts moving out of Baltimore. We went to the TV station like at 11 o'clock one night and moved the ring out of Channel 11. They didn't even tell them we were leaving. We moved the ring and moved it down the street to Turner, to TBS there, which was
right
on West Peachtree Street. And the first Saturday I went in to put the ring up at Channel 17, I couldn't get anybody to come to the doors about 8:30 on a Saturday morning. I took my pocket knife, I jimmied the back door, got inside, didn't have any idea where I was going. I just wandered around until I heard somebody, and I went in through the control room, and there was a guy sitting in there running the control panel. He was smoking a joint. He was barefooted. He was playing a guitar. And when I told him what I was there for, he said, "Oh, cool, man." He just, I mean, he, you know, that's how relaxed that place was.
He was probably the security guard, too.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, that's how relaxed that place was when we first went over there. And you know, I've told people there was a catwalk over the ring. You couldn't,
yep,
see it. It was black. It was above the lights. Many Saturdays, Turner would, you know, he'd lay out drunk all night Friday night. He'd come in there and sleep it off in his office. Many Saturday mornings, he'd be up on that catwalk watching the matches.
Yep.
I don't know if you guys have ever heard it, but, you know, speaking about Turner and the studios and whatnot, we had the honor of having Bill Tush on Ringside Rap one week. This was a few years back, and I don't know if you guys heard that or our listeners heard that, but if you missed it, you need to go back and find that archive. That's just a wonderful story from that period of time, from the 70s, and just great stuff.
Well, you know, Ted Turner did right by Bill Tush after things got too big for him here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, Bill Tush was basically the star of Channel 17 in the early days.
Yep.
And his 3:30 in the morning newscast that he did with the dog.
Right.
And, you know, unfortunately, that was before most folks had videotape, so it was impossible for the folks at home to capture that. You either were up for it, or if they may run a little, you know, blurb of it sometime later, but there were people literally setting their alarm clocks so they could get up and watch Bill Tush do the news at 3:30 in the morning.
Right.
And you know, as the station got too big for that sort of thing, they moved Tush into other areas. But I think he's one of the people that Ted Turner, you know, realized helped make a name for the station, and he certainly did.
And a very funny guy too. Great.
Oh, yeah.
And that skit show, you know, Jan Hooks came off of that.
Absolutely. Yes.
God, what a funny lady she was.
Yeah, and the husband and wife team, the Turners, that later on were the head writers and I think produced 70s show,
right?
Bonnie Turner and her husband.
Yep.
They were on that show too.
Awesome stuff. You know, before we let you get out of here, I want to talk to you a little bit about radio. Obviously, you're getting your beginnings or origins in radio, but you talked about WPLO, and I got to tell you, when I was thinking about doing the show, you know, this, that, and the other today, and putting some thoughts together, I have no idea why this name came up, and I don't even know if you got to work with this guy or not. Maybe a different era, but you guys may remember the name Len Anthony.
Oh yeah.
WPLO, late 70s,
yeah,
right?
He came after my time there, but still, I was working in radio in Atlanta when he was the morning guy on WPLO, and you know, even as late as the late 70s, WPLO was still the country music station in Atlanta. They went country in 66. Honest John Fox was the only guy that was left over from the top 40 format, and he stayed for a number of years. He was there through the time that I worked there, which was 70 and 71. Len Anthony came in, and of course he was pre Rhubarb and all the later guys. He did a good job, and I think later on when that station, you know, when WPLO was sold out and the FM became the station, and then it was sold. He wanted to stay in Atlanta. He had a little TV show at one time on Channel 36, showing some old country music stuff. But at any rate, I saw his name pop up on another station. He tried to stay around, and then, you know, several years later, I saw an obituary for him in the Atlanta Journal.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but he was. You know, obviously, his radio name is. A lot of guys in radio would, if their last name either sounded profane or, you know, something people could make fun of, or just wasn't a radio name, they would, if they could, because they had FCC licenses and show their real name on it, they'd take their middle name, which generally would be, you know, a better fit, and that would become their stage name. And Len Anthony's name, I can't think of his last name, but Anthony was his middle name. You know, in my case, I just thought Claude Jeffrey West wasn't going to make it on the radio, and so I took my middle initial and made J out of it, and that's where my name came from. But most guys tried to incorporate something of their real name as much as possible, so when you got stopped by the cops and you'd say, "Who are you?" and you'd say this, and they'd say, "Well, that's not what your driver's license said." But honest, officer. And so, you know, that's kind of the way that worked.
You know, I was actually kind of amazed that name came to me, because I remember growing up with that station, because my dad pretty much had it glued to that, you know, anytime we were in the car. And I remember that name, and I probably hadn't thought of that guy since the last time I probably listened to that station in the late 70s, maybe early 80s.
Is that right? Another guy I worked with him was Jim Howell, who'd worked at WFB.
Oh, that rings a bell, too. Yeah.
And another guy that worked there was named Les Reed, and I worked with Les at WSSA in Marl off and on several times, and he ended up down in Griffin later on. I hadn't seen him in a long time, but I belong to the Georgia Radio Hall of Fame, and we get together in October, and whoever pays off the folks that are voting the most gets the award that year. But at any rate, well, that's how it works. And no, it doesn't. They'll pull my membership. But at any rate, you know, and you get a chance to, it's kind of like Cauliflower Alley, Bobby, and things like that. You get a chance to see folks you hadn't seen, you know, in a long time. And
right.
If you got grudges because they fired you or you fired them, then, you know, you either ignore them or try to pretend like it didn't happen, or, you know, if you really can, you know, make an apology or take there.
You know, there's another name I wanted to ask you about, because in doing some of that research, I ended up happening upon a website, and you've probably seen it because you're a radio guy, but I'll send you the link. I got to send you the link. But there's a picture from 1965, WPLO. It may be 66, but it had a list of DJs and some pictures, and it's like a really bad copy. It's not even, you know, real photos. It looks like a sketch or something. But a name on there, and I got to ask you about it, Bob Harper. Is that the Bobby Harper?
Oh, yeah, Skinny Bobby Harper.
Yeah.
He came down Now, this is in 65, WPLO was still top 40. You know, WQXI was beating them to death. And at any rate, Harper came down from Cincinnati, and I met him. And this is before I got into radio, and how I met him, and it's the old music business story. The little band I was playing with in high school in my junior and senior year, 65, I was a senior, and Skinny Bobby Harper was working at WPLO, was the MC for the big hop every Thursday night at the roller rink in College Park. And so my band was playing there on Thursday nights. It was hard to get a, you know, it was a high school bunch. It was hard to get a, since you couldn't play where they sold, serve liquor. It was, you know, that was one of the few Thursday night gigs you could get. And so we played there, and I met Bobby Harper and went down to the WPLO studios, not knowing that six years later I'd be working there. And, you know, he kind of told me his story. And then WPLO went country. And he went to, and he was great on WPLO. And he had all the sound effects and all that stuff. Then he got hired by WQXI, and they put him on from 9 to midnight, which was not a good place for him. And they said, you know, cut out the sound effects and all the stuff, the characters he was doing, which left him with nothing. But he stuck around for a long time, but after he had his child, he got out of the business and, you know, went to work a legit job doing public affairs for, I can't remember who it is now, but he went legit. And he actually had a little show on Channel 17 with Freddie for a short period of time. And so, you know, he did all sorts of stuff, but that was the Skinny Bobby Harper.
And he was the inspiration for the Dr. Johnny Fever character, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, the story that they tell, and I'm sure you've seen it, about dropping the turkeys, the live turkeys,
oh,
out
yeah.
of the helicopter, that was an absolute true story.
Oh, God. That's must-see television every year here, Thanksgiving. We actually, as we sit down to dinner, do our little Thanksgiving ritual, we crank that up.
Yep.
Watch it while we're eating.
They just didn't, the radio, the guys didn't know turkeys couldn't fly. Okay, there you go.
That's 30 minutes of the best television ever made right
Absolutely,
there.
And it holds up, too. But, you know, I critiqued it a little bit. You know, anybody that's in a business where you where the show's on, a lawyer, I'm sure, does the same thing with lawyer shows, and doctors do it with doctor shows. But I did kind of look at that show a little bit different because, you know, I could say, well, that's not the way you do that. But, hell, who cared? But, you know, I did because that's not accurate. Well, you know, it makes a better show that way. You know, the records that never ran out, and things like that. But guys like Les Nessman, you know, you had at least one of them in every station.
Yeah, that's kind of like me. I nitpick any time I'm watching a band play on television in a scripted TV show format.
Oh yeah, and you know
the drummer's never doing what he's supposed to be doing.
Or you see somebody playing the piano, you know, and you're only seeing them from above the piano, and taking these little moves, and they're not playing. And I can spot it.
Or somebody strumming a bass like a guitar.
Yeah, and I can spot a guitar player anytime that, you know, they're playing to a track.
Yep.
And, you know, you can tell whether they can play or not. But even if they can play, you can tell whether they're actually, you know, it's not just hitting the notes. That's not all that's required to make that sound come out, you know. And so I watch that too, but that's just me.
Hey, guys, one other thing. The name Freddie Miller keeps coming up throughout this conversation. I'd just like to know, whatever became of him toward the late 80s, what
I'm sure, Bobby, you know more about that than me.
Freddie, when he left Georgia Championship Wrestling, Freddie continued to run. Freddie had his own company called Freddie Miller Advertising.
Right.
He continued to run an advertising agency, and he would book and do voiceovers where, you know, wherever he could find, you know, whatever he sold, whatever he did. But he also did, he came back in 85 and did a couple of TV shows for Ann Guckel when she tried to revive and run a few shows in 85 when I was working with her. Shortly after that, Freddie passed away. But he stayed busy. I think he slowed down a little bit there toward the end because, of course, like everybody else, he was getting a few years on him. But
right.
Freddie's career was so varied and so, people don't know. Freddie Miller did play-by-play for Georgia Tech back in the 50s. He was
Absolutely.
Before Al Ciraldo.
Yep.
you know.
he didn't think he got the respect he deserved, and he probably didn't. But you
know, he was very bitter toward a lot of you know.
He was, and I will say, and I don't think this is any secret, wrestling to him was a paycheck.
Yes.
And he thought he should have been doing better stuff, but I knew Freddie's work from the early days, and he was what I'd call a journeyman. TV announcer, he did whatever they wanted him to do, and it was a job, and he did it. And you know, Ed Capel kind of went the same way. Ed was a TV host, and when he got the opportunity to just go full time with an advertising agency, he did that. He stayed with the wrestling show, and you know, he worked Mid Atlantic later on. But Ed ended up doing the advertising business, and I think he was probably a little bit more successful with it than Freddie was.
Yeah.
But I saw Ed when I was working at Kix in '82, and that was the last time I saw him, and that was the only time I ever really talked to him about the wrestling business, and just a little bit when he came in, somebody was bringing him around, showing him the studios while I was on the air, and I started talking to him a little bit, but he seemed to be a very nice guy. And both Freddie and Ed came from the same era, and I respected both of them immensely.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Ed Capel, I mean, you may know this, you may not, Joe. You know, they actually worked an angle with him back early 60s or late 50s, worked an angle with him where he actually got in the ring.
Was that with Freddie Blassie?
Was with Freddie Blassie.
Yeah, and yeah. I think it was shortly after that Blassie got stabbed.
Right, could have been, yeah.
Yeah, but at any rate, yes, I remember that. And as far as I know, that's the only time Ed ever did anything.
Only time he ever was that I ever know about. But I know that we talked about that. Me and Ed had talked about that because I had heard about it. But they did that little deal because they started it during interviews. They built up an animosity between themselves doing the interviews, and it led to one thing or another. And it was a handicap match. It was actually Blassie against, I think it was Gunkel and him.
Yeah, that was
December 60.
Yeah,
if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Well, Jay, man, it's been great having you for an hour. And
hang on a minute, we got to do one Jay West story right quick before we let you go.
Uh-oh.
I'm gonna tell you something. Jay West is the calmest, most under control individual I have ever met in my life. And I say that with all sincerity because what I'm fixing to tell you is the absolute truth, Rich. He announced a spot show for us one night in Forest Park, Georgia. I'm pretty sure it was Forest Park.
Yeah, that's exactly where it was.
You know where I'm going, don't you?
Yeah, he already knows the story.
He got into an altercation in the parking lot, and I don't know. I don't remember what set it up. They bumped cars, or
yep.
I don't remember exactly what happened. But a guy got out and took a hammer with Jay sitting in the car and proceeded to pound on Jay's windshield with a hammer. Now, Jay never got out of the car. I wouldn't have got out of the car. That's understandable. What that guy didn't know, Jay had a .357 laying on the seat next to him.
it was actually a .38 special.
The story's getting bigger.
And when I heard
the story the next day, my first question was, why didn't you shoot him?
Well, that's what Tom Ernesto said to me. And, you know, I just didn't think I was working in Forest Park at the station there in Forest Park. And Jerry Stubbs, you know, worked down there and he spoke up for me. But, you know, I would have gone to jail if it hadn't been for Jerry. And here I was sitting in my car. And this guy had his kids and he was drunk and he popped me from back and I didn't like it. So I just kind of eased back into him a little bit. And he got out, and he yelled at me, and he said, if you do that again, you're going to be sorry. So, you know, okay, what are you going to do, man? So I snudged him one more time because he had popped me really hard. I mean, I had, neck stuff out of it. And so he came up, and I couldn't believe it, and it wasn't a hammer, it was a tire iron. And he put it through my window, and actually I was a little dazed. But I couldn't see. The fact that he was kind of a family guy, and here I was, a young guy who was a radio announcer and doing wrestling, it was very hard for me to come out looking right, even though I didn't get out of the car. But, yeah, that's got to be the low light, and it was the one spot show that I did for Freddie because he said he couldn't be there that night. So I can thank Freddie for that one, too.
Oh, man.
But I thank you, Bobby.
That's the only story I got on him. So
I wasn't going to mention that because it's you know, it's kind of like my leaving Georgia Championship Wrestling, and that's another story. But at any rate, you know, it wasn't one of my highlights. But I do agree with you that if that had happened to me now, I don't think the guy'd be living. You know,
yeah.
Well, Jay.
I've certainly enjoyed it, and I don't know if there's hadn't been any other callers, so I don't know if anybody was interested in what I was talking about or not. But it's been a long time since I've mentioned some of this stuff. Even when we get together, we don't, you know, we talk about other things. But hopefully, the folks listening tonight, or when they're listening at some time in the future, maybe we've talked about something tonight that they didn't know about, that they care about, or whatnot. But I've certainly enjoyed it, and I appreciate talking to you guys, and certainly I appreciate Mike bringing the invitation out for me to be on.
All right, Jay. It was definitely a pleasure. It's always a pleasure talking to you, man.
Okay, guys. Thanks,
Jay.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Good night.
All right, let's see. We're going to take a break, and a short break, and we will be back with a surprise guest and an announcement about the show, what's going to be coming up here shortly. We'll be right back.
Wrestling fans, Anarchy Wrestling television tapings are the second and fourth Saturdays of every month at 4236 Level Grove Road in Cornelia, Georgia. For more information on Anarchy Wrestling and on the shows, to watch the television product and a whole lot more, go to anarchy-wrestling.net. That's Anarchy Wrestling, the second and fourth Saturdays of every month in Cornelia, Georgia.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
Whether you're having an autograph session, personal appearance, or live event, we got just the person you need to contact for all of those needs. SBI Bookings is home of some of the best stars in the wrestling industry today. They provide you with the best talent this business has to offer, from Kevin Nash, Larry Zbysko, Scott Steiner, and many, many more. So who will you contact next time you're planning an event? The men of SBI Bookings. Check them out at sbibookings.com.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Soley? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
Welcome back to Peach State Pandemonium. Rich Tate filling in for Mike Norris tonight, and Jerry Oates is out. Hopefully back next week, and of course it's me and Bobby Simmons tonight. And we're going to be joined by a guy. We're going to go ahead and make an announcement now about the future of the show, at least a temporary fill-in for Mike while he's dealing with some personal stuff that we spoke about earlier in the show. We're joined by Bo James. Bo, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be here. How's everybody doing tonight?
All right, man. Of course, you know, Bo, you've been a frequent guest, I believe, on the show. We've had you on Ringside Rap, and I think you might have even been on Georgia Wrestling Now. Appreciate you being interested in doing the fill-in gig, and hopefully, I guess, maybe get started next week, right?
Yeah, I'm, you know, ready to jump in.
Wait, you mean I got to work with him?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And you got to put him over, too, man.
I put everybody over I ever been with to work with. That's not a problem.
This will just give me and Bobby two more hours to talk to each other.
We appreciate you jumping in here, Bo. It's this is our this is my favorite. Rich, I ain't ever told you this, but I've told Bo this. When you first asked me to do this, I thought of every reason in the world why I didn't want to do this stupid show. But when I started doing it, this is now my favorite 2 hours of the week. And when we don't do it, I feel like I've missed something. So
well, you notice how perfectly I timed it around Mobile. You were on your way to Mobile when I called you, Nash.
So I
kind of knew that, getting around that nostalgia down there, you were going to be like, okay, well, yeah, okay, I can do this. I can do this every week.
It's turned into a lot of fun.
Just as a listener every week, it's a lot of fun, especially if you're somebody that, had been in the dressing room over the years because you just listen to the boys talk on here. That's one big thing that's missing everywhere I go.
Yeah, I know the show's just been, a huge success, and, we owe it all to Mike and Bobby and Jerry, and I'm sure, Bo's, you're going to do a fantastic job with it as well. And, one thing I want to do is just thank all the listeners that tune in each week, whether it's live or via the archive, and keep visiting all the websites that we have going on and just the support of it. It's just, this is actually between we started the network. The first show was actually 2008. We ran a whole year, and then the next year we started having a series of shows throughout the week, different days, different themes, and whatnot. And we finally hit our stride because some shows just kind of came and went, and some lasted for about a year, and then they'd go away. Just something about the last couple of years having this show. And Ringside Rap and Georgia Wrestling Now would just seem to have actually hit a niche, just kind of settled in and hit our stride where we've got three really good shows that just run each week, and at least for the most part, just about each week, and just always entertaining, and the audience just continues to grow.
Well, thanks, boss. I appreciate that. Is there a raise? There'll
be a little something in
grease.
Yeah, there'll be a little something in your next check.
I started to say you better watch out. Bobby will be having his own sponsors like Magic Jack, like Michael has.
Oh God!
I missed the first few minutes, but Bobby, have you talked to Michael today?
I have not talked to him today.
I hadn't either.
No emails, so I'm assuming no news is good news.
Yeah.
But he's got so much going on, I'm trying not to bother him. But I know that he was supposed to meet with the insurance adjuster this week on the house, and he's just been trying to take care of his dad and make some arrangements for him. So I think you've probably talked to him since I have. He's doing okay. He's held up remarkably well. I worry about him at night when he's there by himself and ain't nothing but him in the four walls.
Yeah, that's he's doing a lot better than I would if I was in the same situation.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
And he's held strong all the way through it. Well, is there any good news today? We've come out of about a 10-day run of nothing but bad news.
Well, they were able to glue my crown back in. That was good news for me. Y'all just hadn't lived till you sneeze and you sneeze a tooth into your hand.
Missy says she don't believe that story. She believes Charlie Smith knocked it out because you opened up Renegade T-shirts against him.
Jeez. I would probably feel much better about it had that been the case than just sneezing and losing a tooth. I mean, it was that dentist started talking about all sorts of painful things he may have to do to me, and I just was glad to get out of there.
Yeah. That's one of my worst things that I absolutely just despise, is going to a dentist. Somebody's hands in my mouth does not appeal to me.
Well, I have a high threshold of pain as long as it's somebody else hurting.
on Rich today. I already started on some guests. I was helping Michael line up, so I'm hoping to make some calls here because I've been waiting to see what they was going to do with the program. So hopefully we'll have some new guests here in the next couple of weeks. A couple of them I don't think ever did any of the shows like this.
Okay, good.
So, and we know dirt on all of them, so that makes it even better.
I was going to say, we can offend anybody, so, you know.
Yeah, you can. You don't run into them every other weekend like I do out on the road somewhere.
And the majority of them don't go into Vegas, so I don't have to worry about running into them out there. Right? So,
speaking of which, you heading out there this year, Bobby?
Leave the 13th of April. We'll be there for. We get there on Saturday. We'll be back on Thursday, so I should be back. I should be able to do the show that Thursday night. Yeah, we're looking forward to it. Charlie Smith's family pays me a lot of money to babysit him. And
it ain't enough.
Well, you don't know. You just don't know. But, yeah, me and him are going out. It's just me and him this year, so I'll follow him around, make sure he doesn't get in trouble.
Hey, Bobby, I wanted to ask you, have you ever been up to the events Greg runs up in Charlotte?
Never have.
You know, I think, Bo, you may know more about this than I have, because I have been so busy lately I haven't been paying attention. But if I'm not mistaken, I think he's running his last one this year, isn't he?
So say that again. You broke up on me.
Greg Price's event up in Charlotte, the NWA.
Yeah, I don't know. I know that he's added a lot of stuff this year that he's never had, because I know Dr. Tom's doing a seminar there all week that they've
right.
got the convention going on, but I've not heard that it's the last one.
Yeah, I had heard that, but I could be wrong that maybe it's changed or something. But
I could not imagine the work that he has to put into that all year long to get those 4 or 5 days off. That it's got to be headache after headache.
Yeah, I can't imagine that. Bobby, you ought to head up to that and check it out if it is indeed the last one.
Well, my problem is it runs through Sunday, and that I take a couple of Sundays off every year already to go to wrestling events, so that always presents a conflict of interest for me.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons I've never been up. I was invited up to... Scott Teal does a Tennessee reunion that's by invitation only, and I've been invited up to that, so I may go up. That's a Friday and Saturday event, though. So,
right.
And then I may even go up to Kingsport for a Friday and Saturday at some point during the summer.
We're working on East Tennessee Baloney Blowout, so I'll have to send you the dates. I think we've got them locked down.
All right.
So Charlie it won't conflict with Charlie going to the beach. He said he'd be mad if we had it the same weekend he was going to the beach. So
he got first week of August he goes every year, I think.
July, that's what he told me.
Or it's July. It's sometime around July, August. He goes. He takes his whole family. He's been doing it for 100 years. He takes all his kids, all his grandkids, and they. I would hate to be a guest in that hotel. But he takes all of them down there, and they spend a week down there on the beach. I think they all go to the beach. Charlie just sits in a room with the dogs and enjoys the peace and quiet.
They have a new appreciation for you after they get to spend the week in the hotel with him.
Yes.
You do it twice a year.
Hey, you know, I've done it 3 times this year because I stayed with him last weekend.
Oh, yeah. So, got your package in the mail today, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
That's the third one I've got this week. Everybody has sent them to me, but I got some extras. I'm going to take Mac and a few other people.
Oh, okay, good.
So that worked out good because a few of us couldn't make it, so I'll pass those along.
Well, guys, let's if you don't mind, let's go ahead and wrap this thing up for this week, and then we can work on. I'll get with you, Bo, and at least a couple times, I'm sure, over the next week.
And, yeah, Monday and Tuesday is the best day to get me because I'm sitting here recovering from the weekend. So.
All right, and we'll get you prepped for next week, and have you in the driver's seat. And, Bobby, I had a good time tonight, man.
I did too, Rich. I appreciate you filling in tonight. You did a good job. And it was fun talking to Jay. Brought back a lot of memories.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff there. And you know, I especially enjoyed all the insight about the radio stuff and that time. Just things I've always been interested in, just TV and radio. And like I said, you know, when I mentioned the Bill Tush thing, just some of the stuff he was talking about, and then between that and then some of the stuff Jay was able to bring tonight, just awesome insight.
Yep, great time. Good show.
All right, well, that's going to do it here for us this week. And next week, Jerry will be back, and then Bobby will be here, and Bo will be in the driver's seat. So
I'll see you. I can jump on tomorrow to Phil to be there to be the guest next week, and I'll let you know as soon as I know.
All right, sounds good.
All right, looking forward to it.
All right, folks, tune in next week.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.